Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Morning. Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. One sign of spring is the new dog owner walking a playful pup along a sun-dappled street, stopped by every passerby who wants a closer look. Whereas adopting a cat in springtime means you'll soon find him or her lounging in a rectangle of sunlight on your living room floor or chasing that new pup up and over the back of your couch. But adopting pets is not all play and snuggles. It involves a great level of research and commitment. And this hour's guests are going to answer questions about what kind of preparations you should make and what questions you need to ask yourself and others before you become a responsible pet owner. Erica Holm is Director of Operations at the Central Vermont Humane Society in East Montpelier. Erica, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
And Karen Bradley is a doctor of veterinary medicine and the owner of Onion River Animal Hospital in Berlin. Dr. Bradley, it's great to have you here as well.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. And listeners, if you have a question about getting a new pet, you can give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-TALK or 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dr. Bradley, how long should a person be prepared to own a new dog or cat?
Well, that's interesting. The lifespan varies, of course, and we find that with smaller dogs, they tend to have a longer lifespan than larger and giant breed dogs. But so a lifespan of a smaller or medium dog, they can live with proper care and good health and nutrition into the 10 to 15, sometimes older than that range. Cats, even more so. We certainly start to consider cats an older animal by the time they're 9 to 11 years old. But we know cats that go up to their late teens and sometimes beyond, especially if they live indoors. So it's a big commitment for a dog or a cat.
And what kinds of places are safe for finding pets that have been treated well, cared for medically and humanely?
Yeah, that is a big issue we have right now, because it really feels like we're in a time where our desire and demand for pets is exceeding the supply. So people are looking deeper and harder and further to find that pet. So in our state, and so in Vermont, I feel like the really best places where you're going to know that these animals were treated humanely the whole time they've been sort of in care, receive the proper medical and emotional support and nutrition, are going to be our brick-and-mortar shelters. They do register with our state. So looking at the Vermont, if you like doing an internet search for Vermont Humane Society and rescue groups, and I know Erica can speak to that better than me, but they really have the nonprofit status. They have the training and the ability to not just I care and I want to save a bunch of animals. They're doing it right, and they are getting veterinarians involved. They're actually even treating complex medical conditions for these animals sometimes, or if they have a puppy that gets really sick. And not all of the smaller mom-and-pop kind of rescues can do that.
Erica, explain, how your pets there, your cats, your dogs, I know you have rabbits, are treated at the Humane Society.
Well, that's a complex question, but when animals come to us for a variety of reasons, we take in animals, usually owner surrender, stray animals, or especially this past year, more transports from other areas of the country that need help. And so when animals come to us, we have our veterinarians that check out the animals for us. Karen actually spends some time with us doing that, as well as other vets in our community. And we make a determination about what their medical needs are, first and foremost. And so if this is an animal that needs some medical care that can help them and essentially cure whatever might be ailing them at that time and allow them to have a happy, healthy life, then, you know, we go above and beyond what many other shelters, especially around the country, do and give them that treatment and get them ready to be adopted for an adopter so that they don't have to put a lot of money into them right off the bat. So we also spay and neuter all of our animals coming in. They're, of course, treated for parasites and given, you know, flea and tick protection. And sometimes it can involve surgery. Dentals are one of our most common things that we do for animals that we take in because so many animals that come to us have really bad mouths, abscesses, teeth that are falling out. So it isn't just when we talk about a dental, it's not a cleaning. Sometimes that may be all it is, and that's all that they need to resolve infections in their mouths. But often it's extractions. And that can change an animal's life dramatically. We get animals surrendered to us because of behavioral problems. And when you take care of their mouth, suddenly they're a different animal. I assume many of your listeners have had mouth pain. And once they resolve that with a trip to the dentist, it can, you know, change their outlook on life completely. And we see that with the animals. We also provide behavioral support for our animals. Both cats and dogs often have some behavioral issues. So we'll work with them to try to resolve whatever problems they're experiencing and get them so that they are ready to be adopted and to be able to live in a home with humans. Sometimes there are cats that we get that's not going to be possible. We have a barn home program for those that, you know, really don't want a lot of human interaction and want to live mostly outdoors. And so we find barn homes that they can safely live in and still be cared for.
Karen Bradley, Erica mentioned spaying and neutering. What age should that occur with a dog or a cat?
So with cats, we still do a lot of what we call early spay neuter. So we can do it very young. Often kittens adopted from humane societies like Central Vermont are already spayed, and once they're, we often go for like 2 pounds, and that usually happens between 7 and 8, maybe 9 weeks of age. So we're often doing that very early, and we are not finding a lot of long-term health negative effects. Most humane society, like the Central Vermont ones, dogs are and puppies are going to be spayed or neutered before they are adopted, which is part of that adoption fee and why these brick-and-mortar shelters like Erica's are the way to go. What you get for that adoption fee is so much, including that they're not going to have puppies or have unwanted intact behaviors. Now, in the setting of clients who are obtaining, say, a dog or a puppy from a breeder or something like that and bringing it to me as a veterinarian, we have seen a shift in our advice. We're really wanting responsible pet ownership and, you know, not having unwanted litters of puppies. So we're really educating clients, and we are finding that in the veterinary world, we are recommending spaying and neutering the dogs at different ages based on their size and their breed. And this comes from research they've done that's looking at the lifespan of dogs and incidences of certain cancers and certain joint issues, say hip dysplasia or arthritis in those joints, and reduced incidences of some of those diseases and disorders if we wait a little later and so that they've had a little bit of their maturity. So a lot of our larger dogs, we're waiting until they're over a year or they've gone through one heat, which can be a nuisance. So we really do rely on clients and owners out there to establish a relationship with a veterinarian that they trust and have that conversation. It's really individualized now more than it used to be just a blanket recommendation, because we want to take into account the lifestyle of that dog and that owner, how much they're free roaming or always at home and always on a leash, and help with the decision, because there's not just the physical and health aspects, there's the behavioral aspects. And to really get the best recommendations, they're going to ask their individual veterinarian that they have that trusted relationship.
Erica, let's talk about the adoption process. First of all, what is the process at the Humane Society, and has it changed any during the pandemic?
Yes, it changed dramatically during the pandemic. So when a year ago it was, you know, shut down, basically, the state for stay home, stay safe. we switched to essentially curbside adoptions. So we our adoptions are based on conversations with adopters. Anyway, you said you wouldn't be a great dog owner. So when we have conversations with folks, we talk with them about what they're looking for in their companion animal, whether that's a cat, dog, or a rabbit. And then we recommend animals that we have here based on whether or not they're going to be a good match with that person and the person's lifestyle and what they're looking for. Because these animals are all individuals with very distinct personalities and behaviors, just as all the people who are looking for a pet have distinct personalities and behaviors. So, you know, not everybody wants a cat who's going to insist on being in your lap at every moment or on your keyboard. And they might prefer a cat that they hardly ever see, or vice versa. So we have conversations with people. We recommend to them what is the best match. And in this past year, the cat adoptions have been processed over the phone, the whole conversation and all the paperwork over the phone. When the folks arrive here, they sign the paperwork. Everybody had to be masked and stay far apart. We would bring out a clipboard, sign their paperwork, and then we would bring the cat out to them. So for the they're going to meet that cat for the first time when they bring it home and release it into their home under our recommendation of giving it a small room to initially get used to their home and their location and the person. And there's some great things about that because you're meeting them in your home where they're going to live, not in one of our colony rooms where they are in a room with, you know, four other cats and may behave differently. So we have actually found that our returns have been reduced by doing this process over the past year, that the matches are better. And we have absolutely, you know, we'll take the animal back, full refund within 2 weeks if this is not a good match for you. And so we have had some cases where exactly that, the personality, they said they wanted a friendly cat. We gave them our really friendliest cat, and it was just too much for them. So the cat came back. We had a better match for them and success the second time around. There's nothing wrong with that. That is, you know, we are happy to get our animals back. We learn so much from the time that they spent in somebody's home. Mm-hmm. We learn more about them, especially like an animal, a cat that came to us as a stray cat. We have no information about them until they go into somebody's home.
Gotcha.
So it is a win-win. Dogs, we've been still doing introductions with people before they go home. Those are done outside in our fenced-in yards, and especially if the folks have another dog in their home, we do require that the dogs get a chance to meet and make sure that they're going to be compatible.
And what is the expense of adopting a pet there at the Humane Society?
What is the expense or what are our fees?
Or fees, yeah.
Okay, so there is, I sort of asked that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there is a difference. You know, so anyway, for dogs, puppies under 7 months old are $450. As we mentioned earlier, that includes they are spayed or neutered, and they are fully vaccinated for age-appropriate vaccinations. They've been dewormed. They're on a flea preventative. They've been heartworm tested. They get a 30-day free trial of PetWatch health insurance, and a voucher for a free vet exam, and that includes a 5-week training class here at CBHS. Same for adult dogs. The fees are less. The adult dogs are $350 if we have determined they would come with a class, which most of the dogs do. And then senior dogs are discounted there $300 or $200 if we feel they don't need a class. Some senior dogs are already just so perfect. And then and all of them come with those same things that I listed in terms of spay-neuter vaccines, et cetera. Kittens are $175, and adult cats are $100. And then we do have a discount if two cats are adopted at the same time. There's a $25 discount on the total. Mm-hmm. And that includes for the cats, again, spay-neuter, testing for FIV, FELV, which is the feline leukemia and feline immunovirus. And microchips, oh, yes, and our dogs have microchips also. And the pet insurance and the free vet exam.
Gotcha.
So they come with quite a little package with them. And to try to get them all set up and started off on the right foot so folks don't have extra expenses right off the bat. Of course, no animal, again, they're living beings. Nothing can be guaranteed about their ongoing health. We do the best to give them, you know, the greatest chance that they have, but we can only do what we can do to make sure they're healthy when they leave the door here.
Dr. Bradley, early on we discussed, you know, the best place for you to find a pet to adopt, and it brings up the question about puppy mills. So, first of all, what do we know about puppy mills, and what have you seen with the dogs that have come from them?
I will confess to not knowing a ton about true puppy mills, but what we do find is there are areas of our country where there are people who raise to get purebred dogs, and they do it in a way that we love, like it's their family pet, and they bred it and have these wonderful family-friendly dogs. Mm-hmm. But what we think of with a true puppy mill would be like a huge barn where they have multiple cages and crates, and a female dog may live in that cage or crate its entire life and just have litter after litter of puppies, which I don't think any of us think is a great quality of life for that mama dog. And it's certainly not a great way to have these puppies have that great socialization. So that first example, you know, the family dog or a breeder who does it with just a few dogs and is, you know, the ones I know, they're part of the family. They're part of the household. They're around kids very young. They're handling these puppies individually. So they have a chance to be socialized and not have imprinted fear and anxiety in their brain. We actually know that, and they've done studies on this, that puppies, so in utero animals experiencing stress and trauma, it does affect their brain chemistry of those future puppies and kitties. So the better that experience in the womb and neonate when they're young babies still nursing is really going to predict and help them through their life. So, you know, we certainly have people who go and they, you know, get a puppy and they like kind of cringe because they worry that they supported a business that potentially isn't doing the best by the animals.
Mm-hmm. We're close to the break, Erica, but does the Humane Society get some of their animals from these puppy mills? Don't they deserve a good home if you find that there's one that really needs a place to be placed somewhere here?
So we don't get puppy mill puppies in the way most people get them, which is by purchasing them.
Right.
So, and in many cases, they've unknowingly purchased them from a pet store, or puppy mills have started to use social media and transport them. We work with, when we do transports, we have somebody we work with in South Carolina who pulls dogs from shelters who generally are found as strays with litters or owner surrenders, that type of thing. And they can also have some of those same things that Karen just explained, that, you know, they were stressed in utero, they were stressed after they were born, and they aren't handled properly when they're really young, so they may have some fear that, you know, needs to be worked through. And the earlier you can get them, the better. Puppy mills, puppies, yes, of course, they deserve homes, but they deserve to be freed from these puppy mills with their parents and forever be taken out of them and then get to go into homes where, you know, especially as the adults need to be rehabilitated. Some of them, you know, they've never lived in a home. It's a totally new experience for them.
Mm.
So there's lots of issues around. I mean, puppy mills, we could talk for an hour or two about puppy mills. That in itself is a problem.
We'll go into that at another time.
Yeah.
But right now we're going to take a break for CBS News Update. 8, and then we're going to be back discussing pet ownership and adoption with Erica Holm, Director of Operations at the Central Vermont Humane Society, and Dr. Karen Bradley. She's a doctor of veterinary medicine and owner of Onion River Animal Hospital in Berlin. Listeners, while we take a break, you can call in 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Doctor of Veterinary Medicine Karen Bradley and Erica Holm of the Central Vermont Humane Society are with me this hour to answer questions about pet adoption and ownership. It's not as simple as choosing the doggy in the window with the waggly tail. Our guests are guiding us through things you should be considering, and they're answering your questions. You can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Erica, Central Vermont Humane Society is part of Shelter Animals Count. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. That is a website organization that gathers data from shelters around the country for information regarding our intake and our outcomes. And then that data is used and is helpful on a large scale for various organizations, shelters to compare themselves to other shelters, but also for regions to take a look at what's going on. I know that a lot of the time this data is used when we have, like, the New England Federation of Humane Societies have an annual conference, and we'll utilize that data to look for trends on what is going on. We gather our own numbers here all the time, and we input into Shelter Animals Count. There's quite participation across the country, but it's still a small percentage. Like, it would be great if every place in the country really did input their data. So it gives us a snapshot. Just like when, you know, we look at our own numbers, it gives us a snapshot of what's going on here. It's been very interesting for us to compare our numbers this past year to the year before and to see what a change this pandemic, made to how our animals came to us and in what quantities. So it's data's good. It can give you, some numbers to back up what you may already be seeing or feeling anecdotally within your organization or the region or the country.
Dr. Bradley, in general, what makes a proper home, be it a house, a condo, a farm, an apartment, for a specific pet?
Oh, boy, that's a good broad question. it is individual to the pet. So when we think of, say I live in a smaller house, apartment, condo, and anytime I'm outside with my pet, say a cat or a dog, it might be better to have a smaller dog. And if we take our cat out, those situations, it's probably best to have them train them to a little halter and leash, which we certainly can get our cats outdoors safely that way. And then with the smaller dog, they obviously, one thing to think about in Vermont is where they're going to go potty, right?
Yeah.
So in the winter, very different conditions. And I have clients who have adapted so they have a small porch or deck, and they almost make like a doggy litter box because their little dog does not want to go out in a foot of snow and trace around in the yard to go to the bathroom. As a matter of fact, it's a lot of work. So they can keep that small area clear, and they can keep it sanitary by having a specific area the pet goes that they can pick up, clean up the waste. Obviously, if we have a dog that has high energy, some of our herding breeds, whether they have some border collie or Australian shepherd in them, something that wants to work, well, they're not going to do as well, and they're going to feel probably a little more anxiety, and it's not as natural for them. They can, but they're more likely to have a good emotional and behavioral existence if they can get out and run, like in a park, or if they get to go on trail walks or get to play with other dogs in situations with doggy play dates. So thinking of those types of things, the smaller animals, you know, our rabbits and our guinea pigs and our pet rats, they can often accommodate a smaller, like just live in a child's bedroom with proper supervision and everything like that. But they can have a smaller area or a large enclosure and get out and have their time with their owners.
Erica, Dr. Bradley brings up some great points about the different temperaments of and needs of different breeds of dogs, which I've heard about. But do cat colors tell us something about their personalities?
Well, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about that, yes. So you may hear some tortoiseshell or calico cat referred to as having a little bit of tortitude. We do find they tend to be spicier personalities than some of the other solid-colored cats. And certainly you can see all over social media when that type of thing comes up in a conversation and everybody chimes in. But again, we, just like with breeds, we also try to stress with people that every animal is an individual and has their own individual personality. Within breeds, I mean, you know, the thing about breeds, they were bred for certain behaviors. So when Karen talks about, you know, Australian Shepherds or Border Collies, you know, they were specifically bred for jobs. And so they have it genetically built into them, you know, the need to practice those behaviors. And it does cause them stress when they can't do that. Within that breed, there can be a wide range of personalities and the desire to do that. You know, the old joke about, you know, certain retrievers that won't retrieve or a border collie that won't herd. So within a breed, there are dogs that genetic trigger is not as strong as others. So you have to be looking at what your dog needs as an individual. And especially when you're talking about the mixed breeds, because a dog may look like a certain breed, but genetically that's only a really tiny part of their genes that make up their appearance. So it's more important what their behaviors are. So we will often look at our dogs, and if we're going to make a guess about breed, we base that guess on their behavior, not on their appearance. So if a dog has its nose to the ground, you know, 99% of its life, it's probably got some hound in it, whether it looks that way or not. And, you know, if it's dragging us around because it's after a scent, then that's the kind of thing that we will talk to people about. How they look is not going to impact your life with that dog, but how they behave absolutely is going to.
Erica Holm, let's talk about behavior issues. How do you deal, how do pet owners deal with biting and aggression?
So if you have problems with your dog exhibiting some aggressive behaviors, my recommendation would be that you seek help with a experienced, certified dog trainer, positive reinforcement-based dog trainer, and get some guidance on how to handle that. Depending on the circumstances, you know, a lot of the time, what people term aggressive behavior is just a dog, a fearful dog, trying to communicate about what they're afraid of. And a lot of the time there is a lack of knowledge on the owner's part how to work with them to help them be comfortable with the things that are making them anxious and fearful. So it's a pretty complex situation, and, you know, you shouldn't ignore it. Aggression is very worrisome, but can be humanely resolved with good training. And in many cases, like I say, it's not real aggression. So aggression where, you know, a dog just is out to go after people or other dogs is not common. Usually they're just trying to get whatever it is that's scaring them away from them. And you should be, you know, dealing with that in a humane way and changing the way the dog thinks, not shocking the dog with a shock collar, and you know, that's not good, effective training. We don't train humans that way, and science teaches us and has shown us that dogs learn the same way humans learn, and positive reinforcement is much more effective and longer lasting than using aversive training that really just suppresses a behavior and then has that pop out somewhere else later. And sometimes dogs that aren't aggressive, aren't truly aggressive, become aggressive with aversive training. So we have trainers that we work with that, you know, are pain-free trainers that do not train with pain and work following the science that tells us how animals learn, just like how humans learn. So applied behavior analysis, dog trainers should understand that type of science and knowledge. And you can find trainers out there that are very skilled at this. And it's work. It's the process. It's not like television where in an hour, half hour, your dog is suddenly behaving differently. It's longer term, and it's real. If you do it right, there's real behavioral change, not television change that is really suppressed behavior that later is worse than it was.
Gotcha. Let's go to the phones. We've got Derry calling from Corinth. Hi, Derry.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. Go right ahead.
Good. I just wanted to talk about a little bit about CVHS. We've had great experiences there. My wife and I have adopted two cats and two dogs. And we've also helped out a little bit in the volunteering end of it. And they're just a great organization. They make sure the fit is good with you, but they don't make it impossible to adopt an animal. Some adoption agencies and even some other humane societies, the rules are strict, which I understand you need because you don't want the animals going to an improper home, but you want them to be homed, and if you make it too hard, the animal is the one that suffers in the end. And we can't say anything but great things about CVHS. I don't know if Erica remembers me, but we have met a few different times.
Barry, I know very clearly who you are, and I appreciate everything that you folks have done for us and with us. You've been great volunteers and great adopters. You adopted a fearful dog, and they have done amazing work with her. And, you know, she needed a special home, and you guys have given her that.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, she's improving every day. We've been introducing her to some family members, and, you know, she's still very shy. And the people that do good with her know about dogs. You just got to ignore her, and eventually she'll come around to you. She'll sniff you, maybe let you pet her. But yeah, she is doing better. We just try to not put her in situations where her fear is going to take over.
No, that's beautiful. Well, Derry, thanks so much for calling. That was a great call. Dr. Bradley, I do want to ask you, when someone gets their pet, what should they be looking for when they're trying to choose a veterinarian?
Oh, that's great. Well, you can certainly, I always think word of mouth is great, right? Mm-hmm. We're in Vermont, and a lot of times finding someone, if you see someone who is, I always say, someone who parents like you do, someone who has the lifestyle with their dog, you know, ask them, do you have a veterinarian that you recommend? And then ask why. Is it because, to me, the biggest thing is that you get a trust, a sense that they care about your pet and you. Those are the most important things. Veterinarians are very well trained and they're very smart. Certainly there can be, you know, variations in the style that they deliver. That's when you get the biggest. So word of mouth is one of the best. There are some things that veterinary hospitals, the other thing you should consider is the size of the practice. Some people really like a practice where you're always going to see the one veterinarian. It's a solo doctor practice. Mm-hmm. And then there's practices that have more than one veterinarian. And, you know, can you always see the same veterinarian there, or can you have a consistency because there's three veterinarians and they all practice the same? So those are important. There are some certifications that animal hospitals can do. I think that the one thing people should consider is, well, what about when the veterinarian's closed? at what do they provide for emergency? Do they have a vet that you can talk to on the phone or reach through telemedicine? Or do you just have to go to the emergency clinic? So those kind of things, I think, are important. And then as far as standardization, there is something called the American Animal Hospital Association, AHA for short, A-A-H-A. And they do have a list of practices that are basically, if they are an AHA hospital, then they are meeting those standards of care. So providing like the safest and most current anesthesia. And they are certain standards of whether it's cleanliness or safety procedures, training of their staff. So that is one thing. When I have clients move out of our area, I say, well, look first for an AHA hospital. So that can be one thing, but that's just one small factor. I still would trust probably the word of mouth from people you know the best.
Great advice. Now, Erica, early on we mentioned the fee for adopting a pet from the Humane Society. But let's talk about, you know, the costs associated with owning a pet that sometimes people don't consider up front. What are things that people will face as they own a cat or dog, especially as they get, on with their lives later on as they get older?
Well, some of the things that they need to consider is proper, consistent vet care. So, you know, it's really critical. You shouldn't just never take your dog to the vet or your cat. They should get ongoing care, just as we should. And, you know, so they need vaccines, but they also need just to go in and have a checkup and build a relationship with their veterinarian and make sure that they are in good health. The vets know what to be looking for, things that we may not notice as pet owners. You may notice something and they can, you know, assure you that whatever it is, it's fine. It's not a medical condition. So I think you should be budgeting or purchasing insurance. And also understanding that when you have really active animals, there can be things besides their usual vet care. They tear ACLs. They cut themselves running, you know, on sharp rocks, that type of thing. So there, you should have a plan for that. Food. You should be feeding your animal the best food you can afford. It makes a difference for their ongoing health for their whole life. And therefore can lower your vet costs throughout their life or later in their life. But, you know, they should be able to eat good, healthy food as we as humans should be able to. And so also the other thing I like to stress for folks with dogs is you should plan on and budget for training. You know, there is so much help out there that's good training that can make such a huge difference on how happily you live with your dog and how happily they live in your home and their community. And it's very reasonably priced for what you can learn from good trainers and change your lives.
Dr. Bradley, those are financial commitments. What are some of the time commitments, something I mentioned I'd fail at for, you know, owning a dog or a cat?
Well, that's, for cats, I think it's pretty much just have an open computer because they'll get right on it, right in front of you. I've seen so many cats Zoom bomb this year, and they like to just put their tail right in front of the camera and what's underneath the tail. But for dogs, yeah, you know, it's back to that lifestyle. And we are actually kind of gearing ahead as veterinarians that we're going to have, when people are less virtual and more in-person work, we're going to have dogs who are looking around and saying, where's my owner? I used to have interactions 20 times a day. Now I'm only getting them 5 times a day. And we're going to need to, so people can work with their veterinarians. There are plenty of anti-anxiety ways to address that. It's not just medication, but things to make sure that we are easing them into a life apart from us. We think the cats will be relieved when we go back to work, but the dogs are going to be more upset about it. And, you know, so to Erica's point earlier, too, when we see anxiety or those, you know, maybe a bite has happened, don't forget to ask your veterinarian. Veterinarians get a lot of behavior training. We may not be the person that's going to be doing the week-to-week training that you need with a trainer that does the positive, but we're able to give some insight into why your pet's doing what it's doing, and when you understand that, you can help modify any negative behaviors better.
And Erica, we only have about a minute left, but what are good resources to refer to make to make sure that you're going to be a great pet owner?
I'm not really quite sure how to answer that for folks. Your veterinarian is absolutely somebody you should be consulting with if you have questions about how to be a good pet owner. And, you know, talking with the shelter, if you're adopting from us, we are going to have conversations with you about what that animal needs. And then there's a lot of information on national organization sites like the ASPCA, Humane Society of United States, that can talk about pet ownership and what to expect. So it'd be good to, you know, sort of read a lot of that information and see if that's something that you think you can provide.
Excellent. That's Erica Holm, Director of Operations at the Central Vermont Humane Society in East Montpelier. And Karen Bradley is Doctor of Veterinary Medicine and the owner of Onion River Animal Hospital in Berlin. I want to thank you both so much for being with me this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having us and talking about one of our favorite subjects in the whole world.
I can tell. All right.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with Karen. Thank you.
You take care now. We're going to break for CBS News, and when we come back, we're going to meet the two people who have been keeping the Lost Nation Theater emoting and strong over three decades. And listeners, don't forget, we have Red Sox baseball tonight from Fenway. Sox host the Toronto Blue Jays with coverage beginning at 6:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. When I showed up in Central Vermont 18 years ago, Lost Nation Theater was firmly ensconced in the arts community here. They had already been going strong in Montpelier for 14 years. It's amazing to think that the theater company has been enjoying audiences there for over 30 years. Here to tell us how easy it's been to get a theater company up and running and gliding through things like a great recession and a worldwide pandemic is Artistic Director Kathleen Keenan. Kathleen, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Rick.
Sure. And Founding Artistic Director Kim Bent. Kim, thank you for joining us as well.
Well, thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
Yep, and we're going to talk about how the theater is doing. We're going to hear details about a live stream performance happening tomorrow night. Listeners, if you've got questions for Kathleen and Kim, or if you want to tell us about a performance you particularly enjoyed, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kim, how did Lost Nation Theater get started?
Well, now you're really putting me to the test here.
A long time ago.
Yeah,
I had been bouncing around the country. Oh, I grew up in Vermont, and I had been bouncing around the country doing theater programs all over the country, really, and most specifically in Iowa City. Those were my formative years, and when I left that company, was called the Iowa Theater Lab, strangely enough. And when I left that company, I made the decision to come back to Vermont and start my own theater company, because after having left Vermont and returned several times, I realized that this was the place I wanted to be, and I just had to figure out a way to make theater happen, because that's what I wanted to do in Vermont. So right from the beginning, Lost Nation Theater has been our major commitment has been to be a Vermont theater company, telling Vermont stories and finding a way to make professional theater work here in Vermont.
Now, I mentioned 1989, I think, Montpelier is the start of your time there. But was there a little bit time in Bristol before that, Kim?
Yeah, the original incorporation was in Bristol, Vermont, and Los Angeles Theatre essentially was a touring company from 1977, from the beginning to when we 1989 when we settled. Well, we had been in Montpelier for 3 or 4 years before we actually started doing theater regularly at Montpelier City Hall. And gradually recognized as Montpelier's resident professional company. So, yeah, 1989 was definitely a turning point, transition from a touring company to a resident theater company.
And when Kim started the company in 1977, they were doing exclusively original work. So that's also, you know, things changed a little bit in 1989 where we the company opened up its scope and started doing plays and musicals by written by other people.
Well, Kathleen, has the mission of the theater company changed in all those years?
Well, I think yeah.
Broadened.
It's broadened. I wouldn't, you know, I mean, at its heart, we're always trying to do. Well, I can only speak from when I got here in 1989. But always trying to do theater that is meaningful to the community and it speaks to the community that is excellent and you know maybe a both familiar and horizon broadening. So, but I think you know. I think it's broadened, but I don't think it's essentially changed because, you know, we've always been interested in an intimate audience actor relationship, and having an ensemble approach, a collaborative approach to our programming. So that hasn't really changed. But of course, finding a permanent home in Montpelier City Hall and working with the city to turn what was in 1989 a really run-down, empty space into an actual art center has changed how we do what we do and maybe what we do and the size of some of the scale of the productions. But at its heart, I don't think the mission has changed that much.
Well, Kathleen, you mentioned, you use this word, and I get this feeling whenever I think of Lost Nation Theater, the word community. There's that bond between Lost Nation Theater and Montpelier. It is personified by that location in City Hall. What are the other ways that the company has become part of the Central Vermont community?
Well, I mentioned that, you know, the mission being to tell Vermont stories. I think we've always, got the most satisfaction out of doing projects like that. We developed an original piece that told the story of the Barry Granite community and its heritage, and we called it Stone. We've done multiple productions of that over the years. That's been very satisfying. We've adapted Catherine Patterson's work for the stage, in particular her novel Liddy, story of the Vermont farm girl in the 1800s, and went to the mills in Massachusetts to raise money to support the family farm. I mean, you know. I mean those kinds of stories have really been the ones that we felt the most connected to and satisfied by in the sense of being able to, like I said, tell Vermont stories.
I think it goes a little beyond that as well. You know, we're also telling stories that people in our community want to hear or want to explore. We do a lot of partnerships with other nonprofits and groups in the community. For instance, when we did the silly comedy Sylvia, which is about a guy who
brings home a stray dog in a moment of midlife crisis and the battle between the dog and the gentleman's wife. but we partnered with the Central Vermont Humane Society and wound up helping to get three or four dogs adopted
during the run
of the show. You know, just to try to, you know, bring highlight. That's one. We've done a lot of outreach with racial justice groups when we've done shows like Having Our Say and Hairspray that bring those issues to the fore. You know, we've served on a lot of city committees and also just our education programs and helping to provide opportunity to Vermont's youth, whether, you know, it's just an introductory experience of what is this thing called theater, to really in-depth, high-quality, advanced, intensive professional training for those students who really want to find out about whether theater could be a career for them, and helping them, you know, launch their careers and get started and make connections with designers or directors or fellow actors from all over the country. Because that's also been a big part of who we are in terms of really, you know, being a melting pot, as it were, bringing in artists that we know or, you know, who are friends with friends of ours to the Central Vermont community, as well as using Vermont actors. So we're always, what's the word? It's very early for us, Rick. I'm sorry. You know, we don't have evening performances there anymore, but we're still, you know, on that stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning kind of schedule.
Well, I get up at 3:15. So if you'd like, I can give you a wake up call every day. There's one other aspect I want to talk about that when we talk about community. I've never had this experience anywhere else I lived. But when I lived in Montpelier for a few years, I could walk into town midweek and go to see live theater on a whim, to see one of your shows. And that opportunity, that accessibility, I think, is another thing I'd love for you to address. You know, I went to 1940s Radio Hour, I think was my first ever. Diamonds, Judavine, and Callous on Callous, which I'll talk about a little later. But that accessibility for a community to just be able to pick up and go into town and see live theater.
Yeah.
Well... I mean, that's the wonderful thing I think about theater. You know, it stretches our imaginations. It takes us outside ourselves. You can go off and it's like reading in a way, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You're sitting at home. You're right in your backyard, as it were. And yet you can travel to exotic places or situations just by going to the theater. And yeah. That is, thank you for bringing that up, Rick, because that is definitely a priority for us, you know, keeping the theater ticket affordable, creating all kinds of volunteer opportunities so folks don't even necessarily have to pay with money to see the theater. Sure. You know, you can give your time, lots of barter. We do all kinds of bartering. Being right downtown is really special.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is a really great point, Rick. I mean, when you know, I'm old enough that I'm definitely a child of the 60s and certainly part of the impulse to get this going in Vermont was this idea that the revolution would truly happen when all of these town halls in our small towns were outfitted with state-of-the-art sound and lighting systems. And we had an art center in the heart of every small community in Vermont. And we've actually, in the last 20 or 30 years, seen that happen. I mean, you know, you look at all of the opera houses and the renovations that have happened in the downtowns around Vermont during that time. They're basically... centered around the arts for the most part, you know, the arts being the driving catalytic force that really is making those kinds of things happen. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, certainly having the opportunity to be in residence at City Hall was a dream come true, so to speak, in that sense.
I've done a lot of reminiscing, but we should get to what's happening tomorrow. So please tell me about It's Him material, A.G. Richard Ames Retrospectacle.
Yes, it's happening on Friday. Friday at 7 o'clock is the live stream. It's as close as we can get right now to actually doing live theater for folks. So the actor is there on stage performing, and there's no stopping, just like theater. Whatever happens, roll with it. But it gets beamed into your home instead of everybody gathering together in the theater space. So Rick Ames is a singer, actor, writer, activist. I think single-handedly, when he's in town, cleans the streets of Montpelier to help out the trash tramp. he's so talented and such a nice guy. People know him from playing the prince and the big bad wolf in Into the Woods. And he does a lot of work at Quarry Works and St. Mike's and the Off Center. But he loves to rhyme. He loves puns. He's got a wonderful imagination and tells great stories. And so this is a show that's created from his life and little vignettes. And the other thing about Rick is that he's pretty well known for his outrageous wardrobe. So there's going to be lots of shirts and lots of changing of shirts. So you can see they each kind of inspire a different story or poem or song or rhyme. And he's a very witty, very fun guy. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah, he's kind of a Tom Lehrer meets Doc Severns and kind of. Yeah.
I'm guessing that the clothing is more Doc Severinsen, or does he play an instrument?
There you go. That's it.
Right.
He's got a different shirt for every story.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
It should be really fun. You know, he confesses about his hoarder disorder. Things like that. And the show will be about an hour long, without intermission. And Friday is his birthday, so he's so excited to be actually getting to perform on his birthday, and we're excited to give him that gift and give our audiences that gift. Rick is very popular. So it's a free event, like all of our events have been this year. And if you like what you see or you just want to support the company, of course, a donation is very, very gratefully accepted to help offset the cost, because we're still, paying our technicians and paying the performers. So that'll happen 7 o'clock on Friday, and you just go to www.loftnationtheater.org, and you can register for the event, so you do want to pre-register. And if you can't make it Friday, after the live stream, the show will be available. The recording will be up for another week through May 1st, so you could watch it on Memorex.
For those of us who remember, that's right. Wow. We're dating ourselves this morning, aren't we?
Yes. It's amazing how those commercials from your childhood just live in your brain.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, you mentioned another thing that's really important to your mission, and that is education in the community. So how do you do this, and were you able to continue any of that during COVID?
Very little.
We did a little.
Some individual mentoring. That was really satisfying.
Yeah.
We do several theater camps during the summer and a couple throughout the school year. The last thing that we did before everything shut down, our own original adaptation of The Little Prince,
that was a dance theater adaptation that we did with about a dozen 9 to 16-year-old.
With our colleague, Taryn Noel. So that was more than a year ago now. But we are planning to revive some education programming this summer. We're working with Taryn again to put together 3 weeks of various camp opportunities for an age range of 6 to 16. And that'll be happening in July and August.
Right, late summer. Trying to figure out the best way to go back to in-person so that it's safe, but also, a worthwhile experience. Over the year, we've done some online master classes, and things like that, but this will be our first group in person. And some of the mentoring that we did, was in that sweet spot where you could meet with people outside or inside and 6 feet away, but that was individual. Mm-hmm. So this will be our first group, and we're looking forward to that.
Now, I hate to make this about me, but I'm going to. I mentioned callus on callus, and so I happened to go on a weeknight, and there were the stands set up around in threes, and I went and sat on the far side, and there was no one there when I got there in this set of bleachers. And no one else came to sit by me. I don't take these things personally. The person came out to introduce the show, they talked about Tim Tavkar, and they gestured towards me. And everyone looked at me, and I'm thinking, well, Tim must be somewhere up behind me. I should mention that Tim and I have the same hairline. And similar glasses, yes. And so I really enjoyed Callus on Callus. And walking out that evening, as we were leaving City Hall, people kept saying to me, oh, that was just wonderful. We really enjoyed the show. Thank you so much. And I kept thinking, I think everybody in the theater thinks I'm Tim Tavkar. So if you run into Tim, please let him know I apologize. But I took a lot of the accolades for that particular performance.
Story. What a wonderful story. And it will be a boon to his heart and his mood.
All right, good. We only have about a minute and a half left, but just tell us what's ahead for Lost Nation Theater as the world starts to reopen and we can enjoy your theater again.
Well, I mentioned to Matt our education programs coming up this summer. We're hoping that this fall we can actually have a small socially distanced audience inside the theater, and we're imagining that programming will be somewhat of a hybrid for the rest of the year. At that point, where we record opening night, but we also do a two weekend run of a show that we won't be able to have full houses, but we'll get as many people in as we can, and people will have the option of being able to see the show online for at least the run of the show and perhaps a little longer, so that if they're still uncomfortable about gathering in groups in public, they'll have the option of being able to see the show that way.
Right. So. We're looking to do some outdoor work. One of the things we did last fall was in that sweet spot where we thought things were going to get better. Mm-hmm. We did a staged reading of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream on the State House steps. And boy, that was so fun for us. And we know that everybody who was there really enjoyed it. So we're working on getting something like that lined up again. And we did some concerts outdoors, both on the State House steps and on the steps of City Hall. And Kim read The Raven from the top of Clock Tower for Halloween, we're thinking about doing, trying to keep those kind of program events happening as well.
That's Kathleen Keenan, Artistic Director of Lost Nation Theater, and Kim Bent, the Founding Artistic Director. And you can find details about the company, lostnationtheater.org. And Kathleen and Kim, so great to speak with you. So great to hear how much fun you're still having with this all. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Great to hear your story.
Yep. Yeah. All right, CBS News Update next. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When life gives you lemons, you know what to do. When a global pandemic restricts out-of-state travel, you roll around your own state and see what wonderful things are offered right in your own backyard. One of the cool places you can stop into when you're in the Windsor area is the Silo Distillery Barn, where, believe it or not, one of the things they make is a lemon-flavored vodka. Ah, but oh, so much more. We're going to learn the Silo story and taste as best we can over the air, some of the wonderful spirits they're creating there. Joining me to tell us all about it are the owners of Silo Distillery. We have Anne-Marie Delaney. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
Good morning, Rick. How are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. And Peter Gilson. Peter, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you both. Listeners, to speak with our guests, sort of, let us know your favorite Silo libation. You can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right. We'll start with, where did you start? Where did the idea for Silo come from? Anne-Marie?
Well, I have to actually, it was really Peter's idea.
Oh, okay.
And I just got involved. So let Peter cover that, and then I'll tell you kind of how I sort of flowed into it.
All right, that sounds great.
I think, Rick, that Emery is being a little, being involved. She'll explain what the level of involvement is, but to answer your question, we started back in 2012. Mm-hmm. I started writing my life prior to the distillery was I'm an eighth generation Vermonter, but I had been in the medical industry for 30 plus years, extensive travel, tried to get back to Vermont on weekends as best I could, and ultimately wanted to make the decision, you know, somehow to get back here. So it was an exit strategy in a way of starting up the distillery. Sat down, wrote the business plan on weekends when I had time, then I'd head out and do my other day job. And we managed to gather some investors together. We had a partnership with Cornell University and Michigan State, who are two of the academic sort of experts out there in the world of distilling. And we managed to get introduced to a company called Carl out of Germany, and they are world-renowned. They've been making copper stills for forever, and they are the experts. And that's sort of how everything began. We found, through an introduction, a guy by the name of George Abetti, who owns a company called Geo Barns, and George built the barn sort of around the specifications that we needed for, you know, housing the production equipment, and we were sort of off and running.
Well, I'm dying to find out how Anne-Marie came in from Ireland into all of this.
Well, I actually have been here for a long time. I arrived in Cincinnati and then arrived on the made our way to New Hampshire in my previous life, and then back to Boston, which I loved, and came when Peter came up with this idea. We always had the house here, and we were living in Boston, and So we ended up living here permanently in Barnard. But the best part of it was when Peter came up with the idea, I realized that one of the things that I loved to do was to design and plan. And so when the barn idea came in to play, I got to work with David Hamilton, who's part of the Geo Barns business, and he's their architect. And so I was working on how to design, where to put the barn, which ended up being in Artisan Park in Windsor. It was a great place to be. It had Harpoon and Simon Pearson behind us, so we were the filling to the sandwich, and it went from there. But I got to sort of design the tasting room, and Peter got to do the kind of production area, so that kind of worked very nicely for both of us.
Well, we've talked about the barn. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, he hates doing what I do, and I hate doing what he does, so it's kind of a nice balance to work it out.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we keep talking about the barn, so somebody describe it for our listeners so they know what this wonderful space is all about.
Yeah, so I can do that. So we painted it red. It's a wooden structure that looks exactly like a barn. We included a silo in the barn design, because we're calling the business Silo. Mm-hmm. And it has a downstairs space and an upstairs area where you can have cocktails. Not recently, mind you, but normally. And two bars downstairs. And we added a patio 2 years after we opened where people can sit outside when the weather permits, and we have parties there, and people come and taste. And the one good thing is we incorporated big windows that you can see from one space to the other. So it's well worth coming just to visit the beautiful car and equipment that Peter talked about, and to have a cocktail or a taste or just see the space that's so beautiful. It's nice place to visit.
It absolutely is. And Peter, we're going to talk about how much the line has expanded there at Silo Distillery. But what was the initial spirit or spirits that you start to make at Silo?
Yeah, Rick, like most craft distillers, you start out typically with a vodka. And the reason for that is that in the manufacturing process, making a bottle of vodka is about 7 days from field to bottle. So we source all of our grain from a farm called the Grumblewitz Farm in North Clarendon. So from the time that we actually get the grain delivered in 50-pound bags into the distillery, we can have a filled bottle of vodka in 7 days. And, you know, that's tied into the need to, you know, obviously when you've invested as much money and time into getting things up and running, you want to get out the door as fast as you can. So that was a way that we could start generating some revenue. And we've expanded that line now from the original vodka to gin. We have a cucumber, lemon vodka, as you mentioned before, lavender vodka, and we also do whiskeys. And the whiskeys have been a later stage addition to our product line because we had to wait for, you know, the maturity in the barrels, and, you know, it takes time to generate enough of a secure cash base so that you can wait for that product to be ready to sell.
Now, I'm assuming that Silo, the name, came first, and that kind of then, you know, created the barn idea with the Silo. Am I right about that? Where did the name come from?
The idea was when Peter talks about it's basically field to barn to bottle. So we wanted the business we started thinking, what can we do in Vermont? What's available in Vermont that we can use? And once we identified grains as being very available and extremely well grown, and the land lends itself to that, we decided that we would come up with a name that we didn't actually. We just silo just seemed to jump into our heads. The silo is where grains are held. It also there's a. It feels like it's a good. We love to see a silo,
right.
So it's visually appealing, and it's everywhere. It's on the northeast, but it's also Midwest as well. But there's something endearing about it, and that's we wanted the name. We had called the business American Crafted Spirits, but we wanted something that sounded easier and that you'd remember it. And so Silo was born.
I love it.
And everything is round. The label is round.
Oh, right.
The bottle is round. So we sort of went from there.
Well, Peter, as Anne-Marie had alluded to, you have this motto or directive, farm to barn to bottle, and you mentioned where you're sourcing those grains. Has that been difficult to have grains from right here in Vermont to be able to use in your products?
You know, that's a great question, Rick. And you know, going back to the beginning, you know, part of what was included in the business plan that I wrote was that I wanted to be able to source grains from a number of different farmers. And, you know, that was all about helping, you know, economic development and, you know, providing, if possible, another revenue stream for, you know, the farmers out there. And, you know, while the idea, I think, was a good one, where we ran into problems early on was, you know, the farmers, these guys work hard, and they're in the fields all day, and, you know, for them to be able to, you know, package the grain and have it, you know, delivered to us was just a burden. And there was also, you know, an issue with the quantity that we were requiring. In the beginning, you know, as we were getting off the launch pad, you know, our demand was not that great, but it's significantly ramped up. So, you know, we were always looking for, you know, a supplier that could, or suppliers that could provide what we need. You know, now we have the supplier I mentioned earlier that's in North Clarendon, and they supply all of our grain. And they also can and have in the past done, you know, planted wheat for us, planted rye for us. So it's been a really great relationship. And I, on average, we take in about 5 tons of grain every, I'd say every 3 weeks or so.
Oh, my. What kind of events do you hold at the distillery in a normal year?
We actually have birthday parties, rehearsal dinners, one of the favorites. It's a lovely venue, and people like to be able to be outside and inside, and they pick specialty cocktails for their groom and the bride. And we do it in various ways, so we can have it catered, we can have a food truck, it can be formal, or it can be casual, whatever the client prefers. They can have music, they can dance, it's all there. But birthday parties, bridal showers during the daytime, it's open for a variety of events.
And is the tasting room open for visitors right now?
So, yes, our hours are reduced. And have been for a while. I mean, we closed down completely until we started making hand sanitizer. But we are open primarily Friday through Sunday. Soon though, with the changes, we'll be open 7 days a week, from about noon to 5 or 6 in the evening. But safety, but COVID has shortened those hours for us. There aren't that many people around.
We will eventually all get out again. And now, I had Jarvis Green of JAG Productions on the show a couple of months ago. Tell us about your JAG Ambassador Program.
So that's something that's near and dear to our hearts. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've always supported everyone. That's never been, we've never discriminated in any aspect of our business. And that then, I had known Jarvis. He had been involved in starting a Barn Arts here in Barnard. And so he and I are friends. And so that was the avenue that that we used, or that we automatically became involved in when we wanted to voice our concerns about Black Lives Matter and how important it was for our business to support him in particular in every way that we could.
Now, Peter, I know you're getting excited because we still really haven't jumped into the spirits much, so I want to talk about that. We did touch on the vodkas, which include cucumber, there's lavender, cacao, and lemon. But let's talk about your gins, which, first of all, you have a reserve gin and a regular gin. What's the difference between the two?
The reserve gin, Rick, is a barrel-aged product. Mm. So it sits, and it depends on the length of time. It's all about taste, so we sample it periodically. But that's the primary difference.
And the one thing that I love so much about your gins, you use Vermont apples.
We do. We use Vermont Honeycrisp apples. It's a delicious gin. It's very... It's not a dry gin. I think it's somewhere in between, you know, sort of a Hendrix, sort of on more on the Hendrix scale of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been very popular since we came out with it. And again, I think we were sourcing our apples from Wellwood Farms, I believe, which is they're in Springfield or somewhere in that neck of the woods. But again, you know, another avenue of sourcing locally.
Now, you mentioned that whiskey is more of kind of a later entry for y'all, but explain the whiskeys that you make.
So we have, it depends, and one of the things that we've done over the last couple of years is we've moved a lot of our the whiskeys for sale, quote unquote, to the distillery, as opposed to putting it out into the state system. And a lot of the reason behind that is that we try to do some unique things, like, for example, you know, limited edition kinds of things. Right now, or as of yesterday, I think it was, there's a term called tipping a barrel, and that basically means when the spirit in the barrel that you're aging in is ready to bottle, you tip it. And I tipped a barrel of rye the other day that had been sitting for about 3 years. So that's currently available. We have a fair amount of bourbon that's in barrels that is going to be ready at various stages over the next, you know, 12 to 24 months. And we continue to make sure that we have, you know, product going into barrels so that, you know, as we're exhausting one, for example, in particular, when you're making bourbon, you need to use a white oak barrel, and you can only use the barrel once for bourbon. And so when we tip that barrel and we bottle the bourbon, we can make another whiskey. You know, we could put rye in there. We could put, you know, wheat. We could do a number of different things, which we do. So we really get two uses out of the barrel. But we'll continue to experiment. We have a very popular maple whiskey. And again, that's all by sourcing local ingredients, the maple producers here. And it's been about 2 years now since we came out with that product, maybe longer. But it's very, very popular.
All right. There's something else. I think this is one that you do kind of just in special batches, but I do want to talk about it because I was over at friend's home maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. For the first time in my life, I had, I hope I get the pronunciation right, Amaro. And you do a Vermaro, which is a Vermont Amaro. So first of all, explain what an Amaro is.
So an Amaro is an Italian digestive. And each almost town in Italy has a different variation of it. They use herbs and peels and they make this incredible digestive that they serve after each meal that you have. We decided that we could make a Vermont version of that. And so our distiller at the time put together a combination of lemon and lime and grapefruit peels and botanicals, and used actually to sweeten it up our maple syrup. And we called the product Vermaro, playing on Vermont and Amaro.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a specialty drink. I mean, not many people know about it, but when they taste it, they love it.
I was stunned the first time I had one. I can't wait to try yours. We only have about a minute left, but one other place you've gone that I was kind of surprised and happy to see is you have your own cider.
Yes, that was I'll try to be brief, but I got a lot of pushback on that from Anne-Marie and the rest of the staff. You know, they basically said to me, wait a second, what are we doing here? And I said, well, I'll tell you what we're doing. We have all the equipment. I have a very long-standing friend in of the family here in Barnard, you know, going back to about 100 years, not me, but our families have you know, sort of been joined at the hip for that long a period of time. The orchard is called Moore's Orchard, and it's in North Pomfret. And so, you know, aside from, you know, all the pushback I was getting, I said, you know, we're going to do this. We're just going to do it. And we had a taste profile that we were really interested in. The cider, when you taste it, is very much like a Prosecco, so it's on the dry side of things. Mm. And that, too, has been a hugely successful product for us. And it's a nice adjunct as well during the, you know, sort of the slower months because, mm-hmm. You know, people, particularly, you know, the unfortunate circumstances of COVID, you know, people and where they can go and what they can buy and how they buy is more, you know, tailored to, you know, going into a retail establishment, which we're pretty well, you know, exposed across the state of Vermont at this point. But it's a great product. If you get a chance to try it, I think you'd really like it.
Way to persevere, Peter. That's Peter Gilson, Anne-Marie Delaney, the owners of Silo Distillery in Windsor. Online, you can find them at silodistillery.com. It was absolutely delicious having you two tell us all about what you're doing there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great day.
All right.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro and directed this morning by Peter Cormier. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.